Do you swear that the testimony that you are about to give before this subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yeah, I will.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City, with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, we have a special guest. Folks, this might be the most famous guest we've had tonight, actually. And I'm just kidding. Yes, I'd like to introduce our new friend and true crime author, Stephen Taltry. Yeah, it's nice to have you here tonight, Stephen. I'm sorry, I stepped
all
over you.
Great to be here.
Okay, good.
Stephen Taltry?
Taltry, yeah. Did I say Taltry?
You said Taltry.
Oh, Taltry. I'm sorry, Stephen. This Northwest Missouri nasal accent, it trips over a lot of words. You know what they say? I'm just a poor old country lawyer that I don't know much, but I get by. Anyhow, that's my stick, and I'm sticking to it, as they say. Stephen is from Buffalo, New York. He went to Amherst, graduated with a degree in English, which you might think a writer would graduate with a degree in English. He's worked at the Miami Herald as a news clerk and a police reporter. You were a police reporter down in Miami, is that correct?
I sure was. A couple of years out of college, I went down there and covered a lot of murders and drug deals and things like that.
Right. That was the cocaine capital of the world probably about the time you were down there. And that would have been a pretty exciting time, I would imagine.
It was. I was actually based in Fort Lauderdale. We had plenty of cocaine dealing going on up there. Yeah, so it was sort of never a dull moment.
It's a little bit like being a policeman without having to be on the guy that kicks in the door. You can come along behind and write about what happened after, just right after it happened. You get some of the adrenaline and secondhand.
That's very true. Sometimes we would even beat the cops to the scene because if we were closer or
yeah,
we'd be there first.
Cops hate that too, don't they? They hate that.
Wait, sure do.
Stephen, did you have a police scanner then?
I did. That was my job. I was sort of the second police reporter, so I had a scanner right on my desk, and I got to know all the codes. Yeah, if I heard something big, I'd run out and grab my reporter's notebook and jump in my old Toyota and try to get there as quickly as possible. But the interesting thing about the scanner is you can listen to it for hours, and after you've been experienced for a while, the codes for murder or kidnapping just jump out at you. You don't even realize you're listening.
Right, the mundane things. It's just like being in a police car. The mundane things that don't concern you, they're flowing all the time. But the minute they say something that concerns you, you know it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's code for a good story, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah, we had some great ones up there. Or down there, I should say. I think my most famous one was when I was called to a what they called a suicide on one of those rising bridges that raise up for the boats to go through. I was at the scene and I noticed there were claw marks along the railing. And right then I knew it wasn't a suicide. And it turned out some old retiree had gotten caught as the span started to go up. And the operator didn't see him. And he clawed and tried to hang on to the end of the bridge, but ended up plummeting down and landing at the base of the bridge. So.
Oh, wow.
It was tragic, but I felt like I broke that story before anyone else did.
Really? So he was hanging on, and then he ended up losing his grip and then slid back down the bridge into the street. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah, he sure did.
Oh, I'll be darned. That paints quite a picture there. You know, I have my own little story. There's a friend of mine, Bill Norton, who was the police reporter at the time, and I got to know him, and, And of course, I was a policeman, and I would help him out with tips and kind of steer him in, down to a good story, and maybe if needed, fill in some details, a deep background, as we used to say. And he called my, he knew my home phone, he knew where I lived, and he called my house one time. He said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, Bill. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I just heard on the police radio there was an assist the officer call got put out about 46th and McGee, and you live at 45th and McGee." I said, "It wasn't me. I never did figure out what that was. I looked out, and there's a bunch of police cars down the end of the street, but I never could figure out what the deal was other than it was some kind of a false call, I think." So I was glad Bill was listening and thinking about me, and it showed he was listening. So Stephen has also written several nonfiction books.
Several is kind of an understatement.
Yeah, well, five. You're quite prolific, Stephen. Because I know how hard it is to write a book. I've only written one short one that's a historical fiction for young adults, and another one that I primarily used an affidavit and then wiretap transcripts and filled in some of the blanks in there, and it is hard. Good writing is hard.
But that book practically wrote itself.
Yeah.
With those wiretaps.
Because it came out of the mouths of the men that did it.
Now, Stephen's got a website. If people want to, if they're listening to the episode and they want to go check it out right now, it's stephentalty.com, which is spelled STEPHANTALTY.com. And check out his books, which include The Secret Agent, Mulatto America, The Empire of Blue Water, The Illustrious Dead. I'm just reading them right off of your page here. Escape from the Land of Snows. Here's one, Hangman, Black Irish, and The Black Hand, which I believe was part of what we were going to be talking about tonight, as well as Agent Garbo. I don't think that's with a question mark, though.
No, here's the one we want to ask him about a little bit before we start talking about The Black Hand, and that's A Captain's Duty. And you wrote that with Captain Richard Phillips of the, I never know how to pronounce it, this word is Maersk, Alabama hijacking.
Maersk,
Alabama hijacking, and most everybody's seen the movie with Tom Hanks. That had to be quite a story to get the firsthand account of.
Yeah, it was. I went up to Rich's farm in Vermont. He lives in pretty much farm country up there, and I spent about a week with him. And the guy has a very sort of detailed memory, and he was very methodical. So he went day by day, and at some points, minute by minute, to what happened to him. It was, you know, a few months after the kidnapping, and it was all fresh in his memory. So we had some beers and just went over it, and I tape recorded everything and went back to New Jersey where I live and started writing. It was easy because Rich had just a fantastic memory for what happened, and he also had some reflection on, you know, how he got through it. I said at one point, when he was being held in the lifeboat and he had a gun in his head and he was also subject to mock executions, I said, "So why did you want to get out of that situation and come home?" And he said, "I'd never really thought of that before, but," he said, "it was really about getting home to see that my son was okay." He had a teenage son. He felt that, you know, the son would be devastated if he didn't get out of that situation. So sort of subconsciously, that's what drove him. So it was, it was an interesting book, and I really felt the movie did justice to it.
Now, when you were writing the book then, so you sat with him for a week, recorded all this material, went back, you're kind of distilling through it, working on the actual book. Did you start kind of picturing it as becoming a feature film that it became?
You know what? Tragically, he made the film deal before the book deal. So I knew it was going to be a film. And I also knew that I wasn't going to get any money from the film. So
I was
going to be on the big screen.
It already was already a sealed deal. But was Tom Hanks going to play him?
No, he just had a deal with the studio. So they didn't have the director. I don't think they had the star in place. And they were going to sort of wait for the manuscript to hand it off to the screenwriter, Billy Ray, who did an amazing job. And then at the same time, put the package together, the director and Tom Hanks. So, yeah, it all came together really well. Paul Greengrass did the direction. And Rich was very happy with the film. I think I think they even went beyond the book in some ways in that they tried to portray the experience of the Somalis, which I had no access to the actual kidnapper who survived. So I wasn't able to kind of give that angle on the story, but the screenwriter and the director wanted to do that. And I think they pulled it off.
I think they did too. And that does, that added quite a little bit to the story to show that other aspect of it. That's often the trouble. I know for me trying to write these couple of things I've done, I can't have access to everybody. I usually just have access to law enforcement, so I don't really have access to that other side to round that out. It makes it much more powerful, I think, especially on screen like that.
Sure.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about my new hero, Giuseppe Joe Petrosino, born on August 30th, 1860, is killed March the 12th, 1909. As all you guys out there know, that I was a mob cop from 1976 to 1984 and then came back from about 1990 to 1993 as a supervisor over the Organized Crime Intelligence Unit in Kansas City. And I didn't even know about this guy. One of our fans, Casey McBride, had gotten hold of me, and he had actually created a whole Facebook page called Petrosino Square just dedicated to Joe Petrosino. And he got hold of me. He says, "You know about this guy, don't you?" And I said, "You know, Casey, I don't." I started researching him, and that's when I found that Stephen had written this book. And actually, you've got there's a movie deal on this with Leonardo DiCaprio to play Joe. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, his company optioned the book with Paramount Pictures. There are no guarantees that he would play Petrosino, but he's definitely interested in it. So we're at the beginning stages of trying to get a movie made, feature film about Petrosino's life.
Okay, well, we'll look for you at the awards banquet sitting next to Marty Scorsese and Robert De Niro and and all the rest of them and Nicholas Pileggi. He's probably your idol right now, Nicholas Pileggi, since he wrote those screenplays and books.
Yeah, he's kind of the king of the field.
Yeah, he is. He's a pretty good guy. I actually talked to him a couple of times when I did this documentary film on the backstory behind the movie Casino, because it all started in Kansas City, and we did all these wiretaps in Kansas City. And I talked to him a couple of times. He was real generous and helpful talking on the phone. He said I could come and interview him, and then something happened and he had to leave town. And then we tried it again in New York City, and I was willing to foot the bill to come and interview him. And I got all ready to go, and he emailed me the second time. And he said, "Oh, I've got to go to L.A. And I didn't try again. So I don't know. He seemed like a good guy talking on the phone. He called me back. I just emailed him and I said, told him who I was. And about 3 days later, I get this phone call. I say, "Gary Jenkins." So I answered the phone, and he said, "Well, Gary," he said, "this is Nick Pileggi." I said, "Well, hello, Nick." And it kind of floored me for just a minute, and then I came back around, and I thought I was going to get an interview with him, but it never came to fruition. I tried him again one more time for the podcast, but he told me I think maybe he's done with all that. He's gotten older. You know, his wife, Nora Ephron, died sometime in the last 3 or 4 years, and I think he's kind of done with all this stuff. So gracefully rejected me, shall we say. But, you know, I understand that, you know, a guy like that's got a lot of pull on him. But you're here, Stephen, and I appreciate it, and our fans will appreciate it. And I think I really want to educate them all, because they're like me. Most people don't know about Joe Petrosino. He was a pioneer in the fight against organized crime by the New York City Police Department, probably the first officer that was maybe assigned to work on organized crime, or at the time it would have been the Black Hand. How did you get onto this story, Stephen? How did you get interested in this?
Well, a few years back, it's probably 4 or 5 years back right now, I read a book and they mentioned Petrosino probably in a sentence or two. I became fascinated by his story, about the fact that he not only was the pathbreaker in fighting what was kind of an early form of the mob, but also had to fight the Secret Service and the federal government to sort of get this problem taken seriously. I wanted to do a book. I spoke to my agent about it. He looked over my proposal and he came back to me and he said, "There's really only one problem. and that's the Black Hand won. And that's tough to do in narrative nonfiction when your hero loses to what is, you know, effectively the villain of the story. And that set me back for a couple of years, and I thought it was true, essentially, that, you know, Petrosino, not to reveal the ending of the book, but he was assassinated in Palermo. That was sort of the end of his crusade to stop the Black Hand. But as we can talk about later, I found out that that really wasn't true, that he had really created the blueprint and decoded the Black Hand and enabled other people to effectively kill it. So he died in sort of the middle of the war, but he left the blueprint for finishing the war and winning it.
Sure. The guys that came along after him were able to kind of stand on his shoulders, and especially during the Prohibition when they got more and more organized and became more prevalent and more prominent and police departments and the federal government, you know, was fighting the Prohibition. And during that time, then they had what he had learned about them as some kind of a history. I know when they started the a friend of mine who retired a long time ago helped start the intelligence unit in Kansas City Police Department, and he told me a little story. He said, when we started this, we had no idea who was who. We just knew they were mainly in Kansas City. There were a lot of country boys. He was from South Central Missouri, and he was assigned with a partner who was from Northwest Missouri, from out of the city. Didn't even grow up in the city. And he told me a story. One night they went down into what we call the North End or Little Italy. They're looking down about a half a block away, hiding in an alley, looking at a bunch of men standing around outside a social club. And they knew that mm-hmm. these were the gangsters. And they had no idea who was who. And they said a little old Italian guy came up behind them and tapped him on the shoulder, scared him half to death, and said, you know, well, what's going on? You watching those gangsters down there? And they said, well, yeah. And so this guy started saying, well, that's so-and-so, and that's, you know, that's Carl Savella, and that's Nick Savella, and that's John Costanza, and here's what he does. And so they visibly took notes, and that was the basis wow. for the intelligence unit and their first files. They had some people on the department that knew a little bit about who was who, but they were so deep in their pocket, they were not going to help anybody with anything. So that's how that's got started. And Joe would have been the first guy. I was looking a little bit about him. One thing he had to fight being Italian was even probably getting on the police department and then getting any kind of a decent, you know, opportunity on the police department, because the police department was all ran by the Irish.
That's true. Yeah, that was his main hurdle. He was an immigrant, and like a lot of Italian immigrants, he had to quit school early to start working. He only finished sixth grade. So eventually, after trying a bunch of professions, he took a job as basically a street sweeper, cleaning up all the trash on New York streets. And at that time, it was connected to the police department, sanitation department. So he was spotted by an Irish captain. The powers to be in New York knew that there were hundreds of thousands of Italians coming in, and they needed someone not only to get them police, but to get their votes. So Petrosino was sort of picked out as a rising star, and he was given one of the first spots in the NYPD as an Italian American. You know, the Irish cops felt they had a birthright almost to the NYPD. I came across one story where it said Irish cops would give their sons at 8 years old little miniature nightsticks just to get them used to the feel of it, and to tell them, you're going to take my place when I retire. You're going to be the next generation of police officers in this family. So it was a power center for the Irish in New York, and they bitterly resented anyone coming in and trying to take that away from them. So he had a rough time. You know, people called him slurs to his face, skinny and Dago and all of it. And he persevered. He thought it was important that he be there. And when Teddy Roosevelt came in and became police commissioner, he again spotted Petrosino's effectiveness and really his brilliance, and made him the first Italian American detective sergeant in the country, not only in the city. So from early on, I think people spotted his talents, but he had really a kind of a wall of prejudice to go up against.
Yeah, it was probably a little bit like in Kansas City. When they had a few black policemen, if there was some kind of crime in the black community, they would send a couple of black policemen around to investigate that. Probably whenever they had some crimes occurring in the Italian community, then they would call Joe out and give him that case.
Yeah, very much so. I think one of the problems early on was Americans saw Italians as crime prevalent, even in that era, that they felt that they were prone to secret societies and they were, there was something different about them, that they were prone to crime. And so when there was a murder in the Italian neighborhoods, I think of that line from The Godfather where one of the characters says, well, they're animals anyway, let them lose their souls. There was really the attitude that the Italians were vicious and low-browed, and you couldn't stop them from killing each other, so why go and investigate the crime? So those neighborhoods were really terribly under-policed. The original complaint of the Italians was that they didn't have enough police protection. They wanted cops on the corner, but the Irish NYPD said, you know, you guys don't vote in the same numbers as the Irish or the Germans or the Jews do, so why are we going to give you this expensive protection? And that's where Petruzzino first filled in. He was the guy you went to if your uncle was, you know, threatened or your sister was attacked. He was the only guy who really cared in the NYPD. And that made him, in the beginning, a controversial figure in Little Italy. He was both loved and hated. Some people have felt he was kind of an Uncle Tom, that he, you know, adopted these American values and he wasn't respecting the kind of small town ways of Southern Italy. So right from the beginning, even in the Italian community, he was controversial.
Now, eventually they're going to hire some more Italian Americans to work with him, I would imagine, and what I've read, and they end up with even an Italian squad. One thing I noticed that one of their first cases or their earlier cases was, again, was an Italian on an Italian crime, but it was a famous Italian, Enrico Caruso, was being blackmailed by Black Hand gangsters, and so they handed that case, of course, to Joe Petruzzino. Can you tell me a little more about that case? Do you remember much about that case?
Sure. Caruso was probably the most famous Italian in the world. He was an incredible singer. He didn't even need microphones to project to the back of the hall. And he was making fantastic amounts of money, giving concerts and selling records for Victor Records in New York. So he became a target as soon as he stepped off the boat in New York. And at first he paid. There were threatening letters with daggers and crucifixes that were sent to him. That's really the first kind of signs of the Black Hand. And he paid them maybe $1,000. But of course, that only led to more extortion attempts and much higher attempts. So he went to Petruzzino, who he knew, and he told them he was thinking of paying again. And Petruzzino says, you will never outlive this, that they'll hunt you down and they'll torment you until you give your fortune to them. So what he did was he decided to impersonate Caruso. They were both sort of pudgy Italian men. And even though Petruzzino was fantastically strong, he dressed up as Caruso and went to meet the Black Hand messengers who were there to pick up the money. And instead of handing over the money, he grabbed the two guys and had them arrested. And it became a very famous early victory for Petruzzino and his Italian squad, especially among the Italian community, because Caruso was a hero and, Petruzzino had protected him.
I would imagine a lot of the local shop owners got to know him pretty well. I know in Kansas City, I've seen a copy. My friend Bill Owsley, a retired FBI agent, wrote a book called Open City, and it he investigated this and got a lot of old newspaper articles in the early days of the Black Hand in Kansas City. And I've seen the shop owners would get those letters, and they would have a crucifix and a dagger, and then this vague threat about how they better pay some money. And So I would imagine there was quite a little bit of this going on. Did he keep going after him as he'd find out about threats against the Italian pushcar operators and local store owners and other business owners?
Yeah, he did. The shop cart owners and the barbers and the owners of what they call the Chianti sellers, which were the small Italian restaurant that served Chianti wine. Anyone really who was making a decent living in New York, if you were Italian, you could almost guarantee that you're going to receive a Black Hand letter or even a handprint in coal dust on your door, which was another sign of a visit by the Black Hand. And what they did is sent you a letter. It was really well choreographed. The beginning was probably friendly, saying that either they needed help or that they wanted to protect them from, you know, true gangsters. But eventually the pressure would mount up. They would threaten to kidnap their kids or bomb their houses. In many cases, they did both those things. There were, if you walked down Mulberry Street, which was a famous street in Little Italy in, say, 1908, it would have looked like a war zone. There would have been, the fronts of buildings had been blown out by dynamite bombs, and men were patrolling with shotguns in the streets, and you might see kids in the windows during the daytime, unable to go to school because their parents were so terrified that they'd be snatched off the street. So it was a full-fledged panic in New York and really spreading across the rest of the country by 1904, 1905, because people saw this as almost an invading force, that this kind of medieval organization, which was secret and frightening and had these kind of medieval codes to how they operated, was infiltrating different cities from Chicago to KC to Los Angeles to New Orleans. And nobody, I think the first challenge was really to understand the Black Hand. Who were they? How did they operate? And Anglo-Saxons or Irish or Polish cops could not penetrate. They had no sort of clue to the culture. And so they first turned to Petrosino to decode the organization. And that's really what he and the Italian squad did. They caught guys in the midst of Black Hand extortions, and they got confessions out of them one way or the other. And they started to learn who these guys were and how they had created what was really a brilliant kind of organized crime.
Yeah, I'll bet a lot of those confessions were the other way, more than likely, back in those days. Liberal use of the blackjack, as they say, or the slapjack, whatever they called it back then. Things were different back then.
Yeah, that was
then.
Definitely true.
So yep. The Irish and English and German immigrants who had arrived here long before the Italians and had all the government jobs sewed up and did not cotton to any outsiders, as we say, they really kind of bailed out on the Italian immigrants for a while, and sounds like Joe turned that around when he got Teddy Roosevelt. Thank God for a progressive like Teddy Roosevelt, and who was a progressive in many ways, started the first national park systems and many other more modern kind of things that we have today, saw through that the Italian people needed protection too, and this was a way to do it. That's really interesting, really a kind of a study in the culture of the time, the rejection of the immigrants, and then somebody comes along and says, now wait a minute, we need to include these people in, and started working to make things safer for them. Probably still didn't include them in on any business opportunities, but at least they started making things, making life safer, and where kids could go to school and providing those kinds of opportunities for them to move into the larger American society and culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most startling thing I found in my research was that Petrosino had his Italian squad of 5 men and it grew to about 40 men in New York City, but it had become a federal problem. It can become a national problem. And after one especially sort of horrific series of crimes, he went to the New York Times and he said, we need the Secret Service in on this, because the FBI didn't exist until 1908. And there was no really national crime fighting organization beside the Secret Service. And what I found was that the service would come and help you. They would come and investigate the crime if you were wealthy and essentially what was called white back then, meaning non-Italian. If you were Irish or if you were, you know, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, if you were German and somebody sent you a Black Hand letter, the Secret Service might be at your door, you know, the next day. But if you were a poor Italian in New York City or in Chicago, you were left on your own. You were a second-class citizen and you did not get full protection under the law. So, you know, Petrosino loved this country. He was a typical immigrant that he had this almost unreasonable love for America. And I think this hurt him deeply that his own government would not protect these tax-paying citizens who, in, you know, the crime rate for Italians is actually lower than many ethnic groups. It was just these black hand criminals who figured out a way to make millions of dollars off of hardworking Italians that were blackening the name of Italians, you know, throughout the country. So it was shocking to me to see even Teddy Roosevelt in a famous case in New Orleans, in Delaware, a doctor had his son kidnapped off his farm, and it was believed to be a black hand crime. And Teddy Roosevelt wrote a letter to this man and said the Secret Service will be there and the post office is investigating. And that doctor had every resource of the federal government at his disposal. But many Italians were slaughtered in the streets or their kids disappeared forever. And, you know, they couldn't get a Secret Service agent to come to their door. So that was really, to me, the most stark example of the discrimination, is that you weren't considered fully human as Italian when you were being victimized by your own people. And Petrosino, as overworked as he was your only resource to getting some kind of justice.
Interesting. Now, I noticed another operation that Joe went on. I don't know if he was a lieutenant by then or not. Joe Petrosino infiltrated an anarchist organization that was suspected to ties of a European King Umberto assassination in 1900. And they're around the turn of the century, right after, there were several anarchist organizations that sprung up in the United States. A lot of social conditions that were less than ideal for new immigrants. And out of any time you've got a lot of people and young men aren't being brought into the larger society and given an opportunity, they're going to turn to crime or maybe turn to violent political action. And there was quite a little bit of this going on during that time. And he infiltrated one of the Italian-based organizations. There's a story connected to that. Can you relate that story?
The Italian government, after the assassination of the king, had some information that the group that sort of sponsored the assassin, who had lived in New Jersey, was centered in Paterson, and they wanted more information on, you know, who these people were who had really killed the head of their government. So the message went to the White House, and they realized that the Secret Service had no Italian-speaking agents, really no capacity to investigate this crime. You couldn't send Agent Murphy into Paterson and ask him to infiltrate an Italian anarchist gang. So Roosevelt suggested Joe Petrosino, and Petrosino volunteered, and he went to his closet, which was full of disguises. He often disguised himself either as a priest or an administrative worker for the city or a bum, anything that could get him into where he needed to be. And he dressed himself as a laborer and went to Paterson and went to the hotel where the assassin had lived. And he slowly infiltrated this gang that had, affiliated itself with the assassin. And what he found out was that they weren't going to stop with the King of Italy, that they had a whole list of government heads that they wanted to eliminate, that they saw as being fronts for world capitalism and that had to go. And on that list was President McKinley. So after about 3 months, Petrosino took his notes and his research, and he went back to New York and jumped on the train to D.C. and met with Roosevelt and McKinley. He told them that McKinley was on the list and was in danger from these anarchists. And essentially, Roosevelt and McKinley dismissed him. They didn't think that, McKinley was a hugely popular president and didn't really believe that anyone wanted to kill him. And so Petrosino went back to New York very disappointed. He felt he'd been brushed aside. A couple of years later, of course, McKinley was in Buffalo and he was assassinated by an anarchist. The reporters down in lower Manhattan rushed across to the precinct where Petrosino worked and gave him the news, and he burst out crying. He said, "I warned him. He was too good. He wouldn't listen to me." But he was really deeply affected by that. He felt that he had a chance to save the president of the country that had sort of adopted him, and he had failed. So it was a terrible moment in his life.
This guy is an interesting brave and dedicated guy. It's quite an amazing story. I see now why they have a Petrosino Square Park in Manhattan in New York City, and I hope they get a movie made about him, because that's kind of the way they get his name into the popular culture and let a lot of people know about him.
And hopefully Leonardo will play him, because they're both 5'3".
Is that right? Leonardo, he's not taller than that.
I don't know. Is
now,
he?
Now, Joe was only 5'3". He was too short to go on the New York City Police Department. I think Teddy Roosevelt maybe helped him get on or something. I'm not sure.
Gave him a pair of lifts, sent him back through the academy. Now, here's
maybe Danny DeVito is still around.
Yeah,
there you go. He's a little bit long in the tooth to be playing young Joe Petrosino, and not near tough enough.
Well, here's a question for you. I mean, you kind of have this great history, and I mean, when you go and you try to do that research, these people are mostly passed away. So where do you develop your sources, and you go back to the newspapers from the day of that era? I mean, is the New York Police Department, are they helpful at all in terms of providing any kind of material that you maybe be able to get through, like a Freedom Information Act request?
Actually, the NYPD had very little. They had a couple things in the museum that they're trying to open on Petrosino, but there were two basic resources. One were, like you say, the newspapers of the era. And luckily, the Black Hand was in, say, 1905, was just a phenomenon. It was It was a moral panic. People just felt that this thing was going to take over the country. So there were hundreds and hundreds of articles. Some of them part fictional. I mean, people definitely let their imaginations run wild. I compare it in certain ways to the craze over Muslim immigration and the war on terror that we're having right now, because people thought that there was a fifth column invading the country and corrupting it from within, and that it was going to result in violence. The Black Hand certainly provided the violence. You'd look in newspapers in tiny towns in Washington or in places there were no Italians, there was no Black Hand, and there was still a front page story, because it had come to represent the dangers of the new mass immigration that was flooding into America. So it was kind of, it was a symbol not only of Italian immigration and the fear of them, but of all the new people coming to the country that was changing the republic. So, yeah, I really found over 1,000 articles from across the country. And the second was Petrosino's granddaughter is actually still alive. Her name is Susan Burke. She lives in Queens. She had some great material. The mom was a pack rat, her mom. So she had saved everything connected with Petrosino, and she let me see it, spoke to me on the phone about her memories of her grandmom. She never knew Petrosino personally. He was killed. So she gave me really the personal family stories of what he was like and his reputation. Yeah, if the Black Hand hadn't been so feared, it would have been an obscure sort of crime story, and I wouldn't have been able to find out, a tenth of what I did. But thankfully, the country was terrified, and they wrote about it, almost to excess.
Interesting. As I was reading over this, I kind of had that idea about, in my mind, about the current fear of immigrants and irrational, they're bigger than what we think they are and what they merely might be. And I can see where, and taking their jobs. And it seems like it's probably exact same thing that the Italian and German, particularly, I'm not Italian, but particularly Irish and German immigrants, and particularly Irish, because they'd been the new kids on the block for a while and were just moving up, and they did not want the competition from another group for the jobs and positions and power.
Yeah, there's always a pattern to these things. I don't know if you remember the John F. Kennedy's campaign, where he had to disavow any allegiance to the Pope. People always feel that these new immigrants come in and their loyalty isn't to America, it's to this kind of mysterious foreign power. And for the Irish, it was the Pope and, the Vatican. And for Muslims today, it's Islam trumps Americanism. And for the Italians, it was really the idea that these crime bosses in Naples or Palermo could pull strings and have somebody murdered in the streets of New York. which was not true. I mean, the Black Hand was definitely a violent crime organization, and they used really methods that are not unrelated to what ISIS is doing now. There was one case where they found one guy that they believed to be an informer, and they cut off his hands at the elbow and just let him walk around. It was kind of a walking billboard to what would happen if you crossed the Black Hand. So they intentionally committed atrocities in the same way that ISIS does, to horrify people and to think that they were sort of this new breed of criminals. Yeah, there are a lot of parallels to what's going on today. I thought what's so interesting about Petrosino was that the answer to this terror came from within Italian culture itself. It wasn't the Secret Service or the FBI or the Irish NYPD who really deconstructed the Black Hand and figured them out. It was a person from their own community, which is, perhaps a lesson to our situation today.
Yeah, interesting. So kind of starting to wind down here, Stephen. It's been a great interview. Let's talk just a little bit. We already gave away the end. There's a whole lot more stories in his book, and Joe Petrosino did a whole lot more things. See something here about the barrel murders and the arrest of Vito Cascio and Ferraro, who would come back to haunt him later on. But for some reason, our good friend Joe Petrosino went back to Palermo, Sicily on a top secret mission. What was that mission about?
Well, he was sent over there to basically cut off the supply of Black Hand criminals coming to the U.S. There was a law in the books that said if anyone had been found to have committed a crime within 3 years of entering the U.S., meaning having committed a crime back in Italy and come over to the U.S. to escape it, if you found out about it within 3 years, they could be deported. And Petrosino knew that a lot of these Black Hand leaders were fleeing, prison sentences in Italy. So he went over there to do really an undercover investigation and find out if he could get a bunch of these guys deported and basically cut off the Black Hand problem at its root. He was there under a false name, but didn't do a lot to disguise himself. And word immediately got out in Italy because he was hated by many people in the criminal underworld. He'd either sort of beaten them back in black and blue back in New York, or he deported them. And so he started to get threats and got very nervous about it, actually, because he didn't have the protection that he had in New York. And eventually he went to meet one of his informants in the town square in Palermo, and shots rang out, and he was assassinated there in the town square. And of course, the crime was never solved. I think in the book I was able to find out who the main movers were behind it. It was two guys in New York who had a Black Hand gang, and who Petrosino had not only stopped but humiliated by beating one of them in his own store for threatening him. So it was an act, it was a vendetta, but it was really a collective crime. Every Italian criminal wanted Petrosino dead. So they all had the same motivation. And what was sort of moving to me when I looked at his death was he came back to New York. He was met at the pier, and at his funeral, 250,000 New Yorkers turned out, stood on the sidewalks and took their hats off their heads and bowed their heads. And when you look at funerals of that era, Rudolph Valentino, who was probably the number one film star of the 1920s, years later, only had about 100,000 come out. So Petrosino was meaningful to New Yorkers, and he was meaningful to Americans because he was almost a sacrificial figure. I mean, he fought Italian crime. He fought to make Italians acceptable to Americans and humanize them, really, for people who thought they were kind of half human. So when he gave his life in service of protecting people who often despise Italians, I think the country recognized that and honored him.
I'm just reading here, because there's a Wikipedia page for Petrosino, and in that the notes say that the police commissioner of New York, Theodore A. Bingham, gave the story of Petrosino's mission to a New York newspaper while Petrosino was abroad. I don't know how secret that makes the mission.
Yeah, it was supposed to be secret, but Bingham was seeking office and he wanted to hold on to his job. So Italian crime was a big story in New York. So he basically let slip that Petrosino had gone over to Italy to kill off the Black Hand once and for all. And he did it, I believe, to keep his job and to sort of win votes in the coming election. But what he did, of course, was expose Petrosino and really betray him. And you could argue that Italian criminals would have found out that Petrosino was over there, but this was published in newspapers all over the world. So it's really an unfathomable act that he did. I still don't understand it. It was incredibly careless, and it helped cost Petrosino his life.
Well, at the time, though, also, I know, like when we've done interviews with different police officers and stuff, federal officers here on the program, there's a lot more kind of an organizational interaction there in terms of one, group, say local police officers working kind of in tandem with the federal agencies, where when you talk about all those years ago, 1912, I think it was, he didn't go over to Italy to meet with the local police department to try to solve these, cases. Or did he?
Right. No, he didn't trust the Italian cops, and I think he was right in that. I mean, a lot of them were penetrated by the mafia or just ineffective in the face of mafia corruption. So his approach was he did speak to high officials in the police departments that he was connected to, but he wouldn't give them any details about who he was meeting with or who his informants were. And he also, I think, which was crucial, he declined to have a bodyguard. They offered to have him be protected by an Italian cop, and he said no. So I think his mistrust of, Italian police went deep. And he was probably right to mistrust them. But I also think that he'd come to see himself as a symbol of, courage in the face of the Black Hand and didn't want to show any weakness. And that probably contributed to his death.
Yeah, I can understand that kind of macho attitude that I don't need any help. I'll walk into the jaws of death and smile and walk back out again. I understand that feeling, that thought process in a man. And Joe probably had that in spades in order to do what he did. I mean, he had to, because he had nobody but some of those other Italian coppers that he brought into his squad that he could depend on in that whole police department, doesn't sound to me like. And there was no feds to work with like there is today either. It's pretty amazing story. I know that for sure. And Stephen, I see the end for the movie now. I got it. How do you end this thing without being kind of a downer? Well, that scene of 250,000 people cheering and or in wearing black or having some gesture for the body as they bring it off the ship and they part the crowd as they bring the flag draped coffin off the ship. I got the ending. I can write the ending for this movie. It'll be great. People will be standing and cheering.
You're hired.
I've been to a movie or two.
Well, but it's still kind of speculation as to who the actual assassin was.
Yeah, that's true. I think we know the two guys who organized it in New York, but speculation has always been it was this guy, Vito Cassiofaro, who was a mastermind of the Sicilian mafia in those days. And he was definitely traveling towards Palermo and was spotted in Palermo the day before the assassination. And he had a vendetta against Petrosino as well, dating back to the Barrel murder, which is a famous case in the early 1900s. But we have no one who can place Faro at the scene, an eyewitness, and say he pulled the trigger. But you know what I think is interesting about it is, for Italy, it was really kind of the equivalent of the JFK assassination. It was that big a phenomenon. But in the JFK assassination, everyone had a different motive. The Russians wanted one thing, the speculation being, or Oswald had his own motivations, or the mob. But in Italy, it was, as I said before, it was kind of a collective crime. Petrosino was seen as a traitor, really, the Italian way of life. It's hard to believe as it was. I mean, they felt that he had sold his soul to the Americans, but what he'd really done is embraced a way of life that gave his people a much better chance of prosperity and freedom. But certainly many people in southern Italy didn't see it that way.
Now, we just had a guy on who's half Italian or half Sicilian, Gunnar Lindblom, and he ran that down, what that was like in Sicily, that because he'd had all these different conquerors of Sicily over the last 1,000 years or so, they developed their own, you know, feudal system to protect each other. And in that, you developed what became the modern-day La Cosa Nostra in the Black Hand, and that you had a boss and you had some underbosses, and they kind of they controlled everything through a structure. And brought that, they started bringing that way of life to the United States, where we had the rule of law, and they were not used to the rule of law, except for the Black Handers, and the Mafia was the only rule of law that they knew. And come to the United States, you got the rule of law, and everybody had to adjust to that.
You know, I think a lot of Italians who first came over were torn. They admired the American system, but they had been sort of, you know, born into a society that had marinated so many centuries of mistrust of authority, that police were hated and the king was hated and the president was hated because everyone was exploiting them. So they found it very hard to switch in a generation to believe in the mayor and the police department and things like that. And when Petrosino switched sides, as it were, and said, this is the way of the future, this is how we have to be Americans, not everyone bought that. A lot of people said, we want to stick to our Italian heritage, as, you know, as painful and corrupt as it is in certain ways, because it's helped us survive all these centuries. So who are you to tell us that it's wrong now?
Yeah, and that use of the word American, I interviewed an old guy, was a kid in the just before the war. I think he went to World War II. He was almost ready to die, and I had a chance to sit down and talk to him. And he grew up over here in Little Italy, and his folks had immigrated from Sicily, I think, because he was kind of a mob associate. Actually, he never really got too involved, but he was on the periphery. And he said when he was a kid, he said, people like, looking at me, he said, people like you were the Americans, and we all stuck together. Yeah. And that's what we called you. They delineated between themselves and everybody else. Everybody else was the Americans.
Yeah, that's interesting. That rings true, though. I think, to Petrosino's experience, he was, even when he was a cop, he was threatened so many times that he had to move out of Little Italy and go to an Irish neighborhood and get an apartment. And that was unheard of in Little Italy. I mean, to leave your own people and to go with these alien, pale-faced Irish, I think that was incomprehensible to a lot of people, because the only thing the Italians had in the early days in New York were each other. So they separated by region. You would have one part of Mott Street or Mulberry Street that was all Calabrians, another part that was all Sicilians. Even going down to the town you were from, people from the same town, you know, thronged to the same tenement building. So to leave not only your region and your country, but everything that was Italian, they just couldn't understand how you could do that, but he needed to do that to survive. So, it was definitely a tough journey that he was on.
Really? Aaron, did you have something before we wind this down?
Well, I was looking here at the Wikipedia page for him, and just so folks are listening, they know the cemetery location for Petrosino, which is in Queens, New York, at the Calvary Cemetery. Folks, if they listen to this and they live in the New York area, they may want to take a stroll down there to that cemetery to check out his grave. There's turns here, it says as well, there are a number of other notable organized crime figures buried in that same cemetery. Some from the Morello crime family, which he investigated, including Giuseppe Peter Morello, who is known as the Clutch Hand.
That's a name. I like this next one. I see your page here.
Ignacio Lupo the Wolf, Lupo. Lupo.
I want to be called Lupo, Lupo the Wolf. That sounds pretty tough, doesn't it?
And the Terra Nova brothers who rest in a bear in Bear Graves is what it says here. I don't know if that's true. Did you ever make your way, you live in the East Coast there by New York, to check out the cemetery at all?
I did, yeah. There's a beautiful monument, and there's a bust of Petrosino at the gravesite that's very lifelike. I'd recommend anyone who's interested in going. And one of the sadder stories about Petrosino was that he was so honest in the job that he didn't collect the usual bribes. So when he died, he had very little money for his widow and everything, and almost no money to bury him. So people like Enrico Caruso started up funds, and they had a huge vaudeville show in New York to pay for the widow and the monuments at his grave. So when you go to the gravesite, you're seeing really the tribute of New Yorkers who paid for that monument, who paid for the mausoleum where he is. And I think that's just an indication of what a meaningful figure he was in New York and America in the early 1900s.
Really, you know, that many people to greet the ship and taking part in his funeral and the funeral procession at 250,000 people, and then to do that, he was he must have had some pretty good press, I'd say, in New York City, and was highly loved by his people there. And part of the reason, I think, was because he didn't take any money. You know, they used to say, I heard stories when I came on about the old days, it was $100 a month and all you could steal. And that's the way it was. That's just the way it was in the old days here in Chicago and New York and all those places. So every once in a while, you'd have a guy like that come along back in those days.
Well, so you have a guy like that, Joe Petrosino. He comes along. He really makes a difference. He stands up for what's right. And does that inspire any other police officers to kind of take up that reign, that after he's assassinated, to continue trying to break down the black handers?
Yeah, well, what I spoke about at the beginning of the podcast was that he left kind of a blueprint, a legacy. And about 5 years after his death, a new commissioner came in under a reform administration. And the commissioner basically said, we're going to do everything that Petrosino was going to do, but we're going to do it with every man in the department. Really, within 18 months, he turned the Black Hand from this fearsome organization into a fading force, and basically struck the death blow to them in New York, arrested hundreds of them and sent others, you know, fleeing past the town, the city limits. But he didn't create the you know, the intellectual idea of how to do it. He just executed what Petrosino couldn't do because he was Italian and he couldn't get support from the NYPD or the Secret Service. So yeah, there is a victory at the end. It comes after Petrosino is dead, but by the mid-teens, the Black Hand were on their last legs. And there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, Prohibition was coming in and it made other avenues for money-making that were attractive, and Italians started moving out from places like Little Italy to the suburbs where they were less under the thumb of a Black Hand gang. Petrosino, I really think, was the linchpin in killing the organization, even nationally.
All right. This has been great, Stephen. We really appreciate it. Now, you are researching your next book. We've kind of went over that, but before I start recording, tell the folks a little bit about your next book, and we will plug your website and let you get on about your business.
Great. The next book is about a famous Vietnam rescue called Bat 21. In 1972, an American Air Force plane was shot down behind enemy lines. There was only one survivor. He was the navigator on the plane. He had quite a few sort of technological secrets that the Soviets, who were backing the North Vietnamese, would have been interested in. So they launched an all-out rescue effort to get this guy. And it's both a story of heroes, but it's also a story of tragedy. 11 guys died trying to retrieve Gene Hamilton, who was the survivor. And finally, they sent a Navy SEAL upriver alone with his Vietnam counterpart, and this Navy SEAL, Tommy Morris, was finally able to rescue the survivor and snatch him out of out of enemy territory. So it's really a story of not only probably the greatest Navy SEAL solo rescue of all time, but it's also a story of Vietnam and why these 11 guys who died were there and why they devoted themselves to saving one of their own. So I've been going around the country and talking to the families of the guys who didn't make it back. And I think it's going to be a good book. It'll be out in late 2018 or early 2019.
Right. That sounds great. Now, Stephen's got several very exciting true crime books, The Black Hand, The Secret Agent, Black Irish, Agent Garbo about Greta Garbo and some spy activities she participated in, A Captain's Duty, which is the story of Captain Richard Phillips of the what was the name of that movie with Tom Hanks? People would know that.
It is Captain Phillips.
Yeah. Oh, that's the name of the movie is Captain Phillips. That's right. And so he sat with him for quite some time and interviewed him. That'll be a good one.
Yeah, just one note on the Garbo book. That was the code name of a Spanish World War II agent. It wasn't actually Greta Garbo, but they called him the best actor in the world, so they called him, right. They named him Agent Garbo.
Thanks for the correction on that. For some reason, sometimes my mouth engages before I really know what I'm talking about. But, you know, I never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Now, and you can also, of course, find him. His website is stephentalty.com, which is spelled STEPHENTALTY.com. Give him a follow. He's on Twitter as well, @StephenTalty. And he's on the Facebook, which is linked to his website.
And what's
right? Just one correction there. It's P-H-A-N. It's the kind of Stephen spelling. So
P-H-A-N. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
All right. Now, be like Stefan.
Stephen.
STEPHANTALTY.com.
And same with the Twitter is STEPHANTALTY.
And what about the Facebook page? Right. Is that you just probably search for his name in Facebook and you'll find the
if
Facebook
page. If you go to the
page,
website, there was a link. That's how I got to his Twitter to try to give him a mention without saying the E. Sorry, yeah. Stephen.
I'll have to follow that Facebook page. I'm kind of a social media person, even my advanced age. Well, it's been a great interview, Stephen, and I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to reading this book. When we're taping this, it's not quite out yet, but when I release this, it'll be out. I think it's going to be released in for sale in a couple of weeks or a month. Would that be correct?
Yep, April 25, it'll be out.
Okay, all right. We'll release this right after, by the last week or maybe the first week of May is when we'll release this, and so everybody will be able to buy it, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself. I know my friend Casey McBride from Portland is really looking forward. Casey's a great fan. He's a musician, and he composed me some music, original music that's kind of like the Godfather theme, but yet it's original. It's kind of like the Untouchables theme and a couple other real dramatic sounding pieces to intersperse as some little accents for my podcast. So he has been a good friend and a great fan. I met him out in Las Vegas when I went out and did a program out there. All right, I'm gonna do my Stephen. I have this nonprofit that I support. We don't get any money for this, and we don't have any sponsors, but we do give a shout out to First Call. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. If you're not in Kansas City, why, go to their website, because they have a lot of resources that you can learn about throughout the United States. www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say, Aaron?
I've got to say that folks need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase as a stream from Amazon or rental, but why rent it when you can own it? And for a donation of $25 or more to Gangland Wire, if you are in the United States, Gary, I think, still has a few copies of the DVD that he would autograph and send to you.
Or my book, Leaving Vegas, How the FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Good night, folks. Good night, Stephen.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah. All right, Stephen. We were having trouble, but now we got it. We thought we were having trouble.
Well, we weren't able to connect the call.
We couldn't connect through because we have to call through Skype where we are. We are down in the basement of an old, refurbished old Midtown building that was an ice house at one time, and you can't get cell calls in here, so everything has to go in and out via the internet.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's modern world we live in, isn't it? You have to be ready for anything in communication, in the area of communication. Anyhow, Stephen, it's great to talk to you. What we'll do is I just kind of give you a little preliminary. Well, Aaron's here, my good friend Aaron Gennark. This is Stephen Talty. You can't hear him because he's across the studio now.
Hi, Stephen. If I shout, you might hear me.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking the time to talk
good to
us.
With you guys.
I'm kind of excited to do this. I, of course, being a former mob policeman myself for 13 of my 25 years, I had never heard of Joe Petrosino, and one of our fans got hold of me, and he said, "Do you know about Joe Petrosino?" And I said, "You know, I don't." So I looked him up, and like, wow, this was the first one. This is the first guy. And as we used to say,
the trailblazer.
Yeah, at one time in Kansas City, we had the kind of the main FBI agent, Bill Owsley, I think his mother was from Sicily and grew up in a Sicilian neighborhood in New York. And the U.S. attorney was Michael DeFeo. Of course, he's Italian. And they were the mob busting team here in Kansas City. As one guy said, you set an Italian to catch an Italian. may not sound too good, not politically correct, but that's kind of how it was.
Right.
And for the same reasons, I think. Anyhow.
Sure.
So you're in Chicago doing promotions for your book now, huh?
No, I'm actually in the middle of researching my next book.
Oh, that's research. That's right. I got it mixed up. You're right. I remember now. Researching your next book. What's it going to be about?
It's a semi-famous rescue mission in Vietnam in 1972. This navigator got shot down behind North Vietnamese lines, and he had some Cold War secrets, and they launched the largest rescue mission of the war, and 11 guys died trying to get one guy back.
Wow, that's
so
quite a story.
It's a bit of the story of Vietnam encapsulated in one sort of tragic rescue, but it's also the story of the 11 guys who died trying to get their their fellow service member out.
Now, are you finding people still around that were involved in the whole rescue effort that can have a memory and can talk to
sure
you about
am.
It?
Some of the guys have died, but I spoke 2 days ago with one guy who got shot down. He was flying an AV-10 trying to get the guy back. He was leading in some Jolly Roger choppers to pick him up and got shot down. He spent a year in a North Vietnamese prison. And so he paid a pretty high price, but he's not bitter whatsoever. He said, it was the code they lived by. If one guy went down, everyone knew that everyone else was going to do everything they could to get him out. So, he was a really interesting character. He sort of changed his life after he got out of that prison and started a new career and everything. So
yeah, really
interesting guy.
Yeah. A year in a North Vietnamese or a Viet Cong or North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp will be a life changing experience, I would imagine.
It was for him.
And look what happened to John McCain. He went on to run for president.
You're right. Yeah, he was in a lot longer than 1 year.
He was, and he was too.
Five or six.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine that.
I don't know if you can hear me. Ask if he did. He talk to any of the families of the 11 men who did die?
Yeah, Aaron asked if you're able to talk to families of the men that did die. Anybody have memories of it or
tell about who those guys were?
I'm sorry for the Vietnam book.
Yeah.
We're just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, I'm speaking with I've spoken with six of the families so far, and I spent a lot of time with them there. I think they're happy that they're finally getting the recognition.
Yeah, I bet.
And they have all the memorabilia. They have their uniforms, their hats. You know, these people don't forget. You know, the war's not truly over for them because either their son is MIA or he died that day. So.
Yeah, that's
tough, but you know, a lot of people want to talk about it.
Yeah, I bet that's true. I can see that. All right, let's go ahead and like I said, we'll do this lead in, and then I'll introduce you, and I'll introduce Aaron, and right. introduce you, and we'll launch into. I'll ask you a couple, just kind of wind you up and get you started on Joe Petrosino. How about that?
Okay, just one warning. My head is so. I've been working on this new book for like
okay.
4 months, so my brain might get stuck a little bit because this is the first Petrosino interview I'm doing. But
oh, really?
It should
okay.
be fine.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we'll work it out. I've got the wiki page pulled up, and I've read a little bit about him. Although I have to confess, I'm not an expert. Okay, Aaron, you ready?
I'm ready.
Can you hear me okay, Stephen?
Sure can.
Okay,
sure
good.
Can.
This is not the National Public Radio studio, as you might well imagine, so we kind of jury-rig things here.
I'm bringing everybody. I'm bringing
no,
him
no
down.
No problem.
Bringing him down in my mic. And...
So when you think it's still with God,